Welcome to that spiritual, actual, factual answers to questions he asking. You find them inside you, recite you, reciting the records of Kashuk. We laughing, we drafting the passion through fabric. It's time for that comedy, dramedy, all of the fanciest, catchiest acronyms. Listeners, listen, we traveling. Consciousness is always unraveling. The reading you're having is mapping you back to your natural habitat. Abracadabra, it's magic, let's pass it. To top it off, the host are the classiest. Now, what were you asking for? All of the answers, what? All the answers.
I'm a dolphin. I feel like with our guest today, I'm so happy he's coming on. We should talk about like your current theater experiences as a nice segue in.
Okay.
What do you think about that? You're doing a play. He writes the plays. It's all of a piece.
He's a playwright who deals with philosophy, which is a lot of what we deal with here.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, we'll get into it. Let's talk. Hi, Katie. Good to see you,
Hi, my friend. You too. How's it going?
Well, before we start, we realized some major fixes for our audio, which we've been having a little trouble with lately. So that's exciting.
All due to Chauncey McChauncerson's gifted nature.
Nice.
What's his last name again? Chauncey Williamsburg.
Can't remember now.
O'Shaughnessy.
Chauncey O'Shaughnessy is a nice one.
That's
pretty good.
Yeah.
But life is, you know, happening.
Yeah.
In rehearsal, you're doing your new business.
Mm-hmm.
Are you doing your new business?
Oh my God, so much new businessing.
Have you actually staged something yet?
No, it's all like buying things and getting bigger storage unit and moving things and lifting objects and meeting realtors and shaking hands. And
do you have any official clients yet?
Well, I have people that are like, oh yeah, I'll use you. Can't wait. And I'm like, sweet, sweet, sweet. It's like kind of you just do that until, you know, something happens.
That's exciting.
It feels good. It feels really good. I actually also hit the place where I'm like, okay, we need to not purchase anything else until we have gigs.
Yeah, you can't spend all the money to make the money. You got to still have.
Right. So I'm happy about that because it feels very intuitive to me. It's not like, when do I stop and how do I know? I'm just like, now you stop. I had some cool spiritual shit go on this weekend. I was driving up to, and then I want to talk about you and theater, but just to pull it in, I was driving to Davis. I went up to Davis for just an evening and a morning to see a friend of mine out there, my friend Dina, who is not the Dina you know.
But lives in that area too.
Mm-hmm. My God. I just wanted to say this. This was the fun part of the story to share. I was doing some energy work on my own nervous system, stuff about relational dynamics, you know, moving in with my man just like confronts me with all the trigger warning, all the sexual abuse stuff that isn't like, I don't have a lot of the emotional charge around sexual abuse anymore because I did all that work, but I have the nervous system charge.
Mm.
And these are different, which is a good thing for people to know about. There's the emotional charge where it's living in your body and you hear somebody talk about it and it triggers you and you have all the feelings and that's very understandable, very appropriate, very normal. Sometimes we can get, you know, if you work on that a long time, you get through it. And then there's just no charge on it. Like I had a friend say to me this weekend, like, I don't want to trigger you, but can we talk about something you said? I was like, no, I'm good. I got nothing. Doesn't trigger me. However, there's this layer of trauma that just lives like stuck energy on the spinal column, the nervous system, when you have something that happens that young. So I got plenty of that left. Whee! So that just feels like, tightness on the spine. I don't know how else to describe it. That comes up as, which I've been talking about on here each week, I feel like, it'll come up like, and I say this for transparency and for people to understand themselves, hopefully in some way that hopefully is useful. It'll come up like, go away from me. Like, I'll be like, go away from me is the feeling I have.
Yeah.
But I know that go away from me in my case, because of the history I have, is 9 times out of 10, something in my nervous system saying, intimacy is a threat.
Yeah.
So then I go to work on it. I go feel into it, bring the light to it, all kinds of shifts happen. So I did a lot of that whilst driving, which they tell you never to do, but here we are. And I was doing that while driving and I had this thing happen where this is the end of the story. You ever been to the optometrist for your eyes?
I have been to the optometrist. Yes.
Okay, great. You know how they do those click, 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 click.
Yeah, one or two.
And then the one is real shady and you can't see anything. And then they click it to two. And then you're like, oh, I can see it to China, you know?
Right.
I was driving my car and I wear glasses. So I was not wearing them at the moment, just looking at the road. And I have a certain amount of vision degeneration that I've had for a couple of years now. And so I was driving just aware of the parts of my vision that are fuzzy and the parts that are clear. And I moved a piece of this thing on my spinal column out that has to do with intimacy. And it and my vision went from 1 to 2.
Wow.
It just went to chink, chink, and I could see perfectly well.
Shut up. That's weird and scary and brilliant and amazing.
It amazes me to this day. I was just like, oh my God, I wish somebody had a camera inside my brain because no one will believe this. Like I can't.
Right.
I was talking with a friend after. I was like, well, I just changed my vision, I guess.
And now like, is that part that was blurry, not blurry now?
Yes. Like I'd say, let's say my vision was at a, let's say 10 is a perfect vision. And let's say mine was at 6, but now it's at 7 or something.
Just it removed some occlusion in the physical lens itself.
Well, it was a spinal column, right? Because the nerves are connected to everything. Nervous system
right. So the nerves are like telling it not to adjust properly or whatever because it's freaked out. It does. I don't want to see.
It's well, that's it. No, that's it. That's what's really it. Like there was something that was way too painful to see. You know, that when you're a baby and somebody's breaking your body, you can't see it or you would die. So like that gets frozen, that can't see it. Your nervous system goes into protection mode, freezes it in your spinal column, and then it's just frozen forever until you work with it and unfreeze it. And so in unfreezing it, my system went, oh, you can see that now.
Yeah. Wow. Wow.
Which brings me to, if you've ever heard trauma specialists talk about ACEs, the ACE score, which is something like acute childhood, something. It's like bad experiences in childhood.
Mm-hmm.
The more ACEs you have, or the higher you are on the ACE scale or whatever, the more likely you are to have all these other physical problems like diabetes and Alzheimer's and cancer and heart disease, because trauma leads to all of those diseases.
Wow.
And it leads to them. It's why we see like in impoverished communities, people that are like, poor and starving and eating Doritos every day because it's all they can pay for. The trauma history in that culture leads to the diseases in that culture.
Right.
Or even if you look at like how this is a broad sweeping generalization and not, I don't even know what I'm talking about, but I have heard it said that there's high blood pressure often in the African communities and African American and just Black communities in America. Blood pressure is a thing. Well, that one's easier to see than, I mean, that
right.
makes so much fucking sense. How much stress has the Black culture been through? Just their fucking stress system, just enslaved stress, slavery, hello. And then you're going to pass it down. And here we are.
You got some epigenetics there. There's also correlation and causation, like with the thing you said about the diabetes and the health being correlated to an ACE score. But that might be that the ACE scores are higher in communities that also don't have access to good nutrition, which causes diabetes perhaps, or it actually is going in. So that's correlation as opposed to causation, which is, well, if you're more actively stressed in your body, that's going to release more, what's it called that gets released when you're stressed?
Cortisol
and all that shit. And that actually is a causation towards some of these conditions. So it's both. It's everything, just like the system being spiritual, mental, social, physical, actually all one thing, so are the systems in which we exist.
Correct.
Like we could say, oh, that's an outside correlation. Or no, that's part of the systemic causation of what we are sitting in.
And then the ways that like the internal system is all one thing and the external systems are all one thing. And then the internal and the external are all one thing. So why are people so resistant to the idea that reality is mirroring your inner reality? It's the same.
Yeah, I'm still resistant to that, but I get you. I'm with you.
Tell me more about that resistance. I promise not to try to change how you feel about it, but I do want to hear more about that.
No, you don't need to, because that's definitely one of those two-hand things for me. I've given that image many a time. I can hold absolute like, no, is that a thing? And like, yeah, it's a thing at the same time. I hold them, but I'm very aware of that there's the left side of my body is going, is it though?
yeah. Yeah.
Are you? What can I say more about that? I still am in, because I haven't given over completely to the full unmitigated acceptance of the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th dimensions.
Yeah.
I still operate within my logical scientific brain that hasn't experienced the other thing to a degree that it would be, that it would just blow those walls down.
Okay. That was my next question. Like, does your experience show you that this is the case or does it not?
Yeah. When it does, I revel in it.
Gotcha.
When I see synchronicity that is so transcendent that I cannot
unsee.
I can't unsee it. I go, well, that's the outside world being reflected in my inside, or the opposite. It's the outside world reflecting my inner experience.
Right.
And vice versa.
Right. Okay, let's do a little gestalt. Are you up for it?
Gestalt me, baby.
A little parts work.
Okay. Yeah.
So like, let's close your eyes for a second.
Okay.
Just, I want to hear from this part of you directly.
Okay.
So if you close your eyes and you imagine that one part of you is sort of into this idea, one part of you is skeptical or not into it or resistant or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Let's feel into the energy.
What would we say the idea is that we're, again?
That the external reality is reflecting your something internal, whether you're aware of that internal thing or not. That there's the law of mirroring is real.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to see in your reality reflected to you something going on in you. Conscious or unconscious. Okay, so meet up with or feel into the part of you that's like, nah, I'm not sure. And when you're there, let me know.
Okay. I think.
And then I'd like you to let that part talk to the other part of you. I want the other part to extend heart energy or its love to this part.
Do you mean the believing part reaches out to the disbelieving part?
Yeah, the believing part opens its heart, sends a little connection line from its heart to the other guy's heart. And disbelieving guy, we want to say to it inside of you, you can do this out loud or silently inside, hey, what would you say to me about this? And then let's hear what disbelieving part says.
Well, before I do that, I want to share something that just happened in an internal sort of visualization. I for some reason had arbitrarily decided that like the left side of my body was the disbelieving part and the right side was my believing part. And I was like, oh, that feels right. And the left side felt much more filled in and muscular.
Mm.
And the right side was feeling very thin and kind of empty. And then as I felt into that conversation, the left side said, no, I'm the believing side.
Huh.
That it just I had mentally constructed it backwards.
Got it. Okay, great.
So now I have a much more, now the disbelieving quote logical side is already kind of it's kind of thin and in fact would like to be filled in and be more muscular.
Okay, here's how we're going to do that. So closing the eyes when you're ready, feel into the thin side, whichever side that is physically on, and just ask it from the other side what it would like to say to the other side and listen or feel. Does it have anything it wants to say to the other side?
I'm a little confused about which is the side, which is the other side. Which is that?
Okay, disbelieving side. What does disbelieving side want to say
to believing side?
Or want to have believing side hear it say, or hear it feel, or hear it do.
Okay, that's what I thought. It wants to be in balance. It wants to like share. It's what it was asking for. Like share your weight. Let us be in balance with each other.
Okay, so here's what we need to do to make that happen. The disbelieving side needs to speak with the I pronoun rather than you talking about it as a third thing. Let's let it speak with the I pronoun to the believing side. and just say whatever. I mean, it may say anything like, how about the weather? Or I like football. Let's go to more games. Or listen to me. Or why do you always ignore me? Or I don't know what it's going to say. But we're going to I pronoun it from its perspective out loud when you're ready.
I want some of your juice. I want the strength that you have.
Okay. Believing side, can you open your heart a little bit and send some of your juice right now from your heart to disbelieving side's heart just for a second? Just imagine that happening as if that's possible.
Yeah, totally is.
Let's just sit with that for a moment while that happens. And then disbelieving side, tell us a little bit about what's happening for you as believing side is giving you a little bit of that juice.
I'm feeling just stronger, more filled in, more less flaccid, more fed.
That's nice. Is there anything else you could use from believing side?
I would like believing side to have more certainty and then share that with me.
Okay. And then believing side, I'm talking to you now. What do you need in order to feel comfortable having more certainty and sharing that with disbelieving side?
More trust.
All right. And what would build that for you?
I keep thinking the word less brain.
That seems right.
Yeah.
That does tend to work.
Let go of the brain. Like, look at your design and trust that logical side. You already know your head is not a very reliable source.
So disbelieving side, skeptical side, brainy side, what do you need in order to let go of a little bit more brain and trust body a little bit more?
Visceral proof, visceral experience.
Okay, that makes sense. So I'm just going to talk to consciousness for a second and say, is there anything we can do or clear for this disbelieving side to give him or it more access to receiving more proof or to being actually open to proof penetrating? Yes. Okay. So Cassidy, if you can just really merge into the entirety of the energy of disbelieving side, as if you are it, you just become that guy entirely for just a moment. So disbelieving side with I pronouns, what are you noticing is happening for you right now, if anything at all?
I'm arguing with the voice of my best friend, who is a staunch dismissalist. And he is sort of the embodiment of the disbelieving side. And I'm just hearing him smirk and dismiss.
Right. Is arguing with him working to give you more openness?
No, it's just a pain in my ass.
Okay.
Pisses me off. It's upsetting.
Yeah.
Makes me angry at him, and I don't want to fucking be angry at him.
Yeah, for sure. Could you visualize him dismissing? There he is being dismissive about stuff. And you, disbelieving side, turn away from him. Just physically imagine turning away from him. And tell me what you notice inside yourself, disbelieving side, as you turn away.
He's fine. He doesn't need me to agree with him.
Okay. And how do you feel?
Amused and relieved of a burden. Like, fuck it. Fucking doesn't matter. That's what I kind of feel like. Why? No one asked you to engage that.
Okay. Then I'd like you to imagine there are these lines of energy. Just imagine them between your brain and your best friend's brain and your heart and your best friend's heart. And these specific lines of energy are just tying you to his dismissiveness. Okay. And as you see those lines of energy connecting the two of you on that one topic, I want you to imagine those lines of energy just evaporate into the space around them. What happens when you see those lines evaporating?
I don't have an answer for that one. It just kind of is.
So the lines evaporated?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I guess it's, I guess my, I think it's because it's just, it's easy. It's not significant. It's not enormous. It's just like, yeah, that's fine, dude. And like, and, you know, I still love you. It's fine. I don't need to give any power to this thing I've created.
Okay, cool. All right. Last thing for now. I want to say to disbelieving side, is there anything else you need that would make it easier for you to receive evidence that would give you trust? Seems like a no.
Yes. I mean, I keep just thinking like less brain, more body is what keeps coming through.
Okay, great. So that's a practice.
Yeah.
So I wonder what would happen if each time this disbelieving side of the brain starts to talk, you could ask your body what it knows.
Mm-hmm.
By feeling into below the neck.
Yeah.
See what comes up for you.
Thanks.
Sure.
Unexpected session.
Well, parts work. No big deal.
No bigs. Just, you know, quick little therapy session right in the middle of a... It's good.
Yeah, that's what we do.
I love it.
Hey, what's up? It's Rami. I'm thinking about Generation Z and how I regularly feel so impressed and grateful for Gen Z folks, for the way that they move the culture forward, the way that they will not stand for injustice in so many cases. And yeah, there are times where, you know, you could complain and be judgmental of that, like, oh, it's not so bad, just take it, we did, you know, whatever. But no, they will not take it. And you know what? We made them. At least I did. I helped make them. And I did it on purpose. I spent my young adulthood caring so deeply about creating a better world and teaching kids, working with kids, being a role model to children and young adults that were slightly younger than me, and like caring what images I put out into the world, caring how I helped to shape them. And while I am not an activist, or at least not an active activist, I'm a, I guess, passive activist, a pactivist. Anyway, while I am not like really an activist, I helped make people who are, and what I did helped them become who they are so that they could step forward into the world with all that, like, you know, with all their amazing power of their Gen Z-ness. Anyway, so, yeah, there's this play, What the Constitution Means to Me, and she's got this one line in it that I think says it beautifully. She goes, I feel so excited by young people, I really do, because they are, I feel like they are shining a light backwards into the darkness so I can follow them into the future. Rami's rules.
Oh, there he is.
Oh, good. He's here.
Jay Specs.
Hello, I'm Mr. Spectre. We did it.
I'm sorry I'm late.
We sent you the wrong link, or we sent the link to the wrong email, so it's all good.
Zooming into auditions in London, and I messed up my time zones.
Nice. Are you good?
I'm good. I'm good.
Good to be here now?
Yes.
Does anyone ever call you Jay Specky?
No, I don't. Not yet, but you know.
I think today's the day.
J-Specs?
Yeah. What I really want to know is how do I... I've never known how to get the cool Zoom backgrounds that you guys have.
It's very easy.
It's very easy.
I can talk you through it if you want. You go to the little caret next to stop video, little up arrow caret next to the stop video button. Click choose virtual background.
Okay.
And there's a bunch of preloaded ones.
I can do... I don't need to do this right now.
You can just do blur now. But from now on, you can do this cool one if you want.
Okay, cool.
Jay Specs, how's it going?
It's going all right. Yeah, how are you? How are you guys doing?
We're great. We're happy to have you on. I have so many things for you. We have I don't know if you've heard this podcast at all. I would very much understand if you hadn't, but we have a focus to it that I'm going to ask you some questions about in a minute. But before I do, just to introduce some of our audience to you, just want to say Jonathan Spector, world-renowned playwright, extraordinaire, local to the Bay Arena, but now touching hearts
was
and
just,
minds.
Just zooming into auditions in London, sounds like.
Touching hearts and minds all across the world at this point. And buddies of the podcast, like we've all, gosh, how do we know? How do you guys know each other? What's your original connection?
I mean, I just through theater, I don't know how we first met, but our deep connection and really like an ongoing source of sadness in my life because of the absence of this connection is that Cassidy and I were racquetball partners for, I don't know, 5 years. And then, yeah, once a week, you know.
And then COVID happened and then all of our racquetball courts went away. So we have no access to any racquetball anymore.
What? I'm surprised you guys didn't pick up pickleball like the rest of the universe.
We've talked about it.
We just haven't done it.
Yes, but it's on the agenda. It's going to happen.
Nice.
This fall, we're going to make pickleball happen.
When I get back into town, we're pickling.
Yeah, where are you now?
I'm down in Carmel.
Oh, okay.
In Caramel. Really, Monterey is where I am. But yeah, working on Cymbeline or Cymbeline, depending on who you ask.
Who says it not Cymbeline? People say Cymbeline?
Yep. It scans as Cymbeline.
I take issue with that.
It scans as Cymbeline.
I don't care.
So is this the kind of podcast where you just, it all goes in or where you edit it?
There's some editing and anything.
We will only edit if something just falls apart.
Or if you say to us after, please cut that part about whoever, we will absolutely cut that part about whoever.
Yeah. Do you need us to cut the part about you had auditions in London? We'll cut that.
No, that's fine. I don't think it's good. Yeah.
So what's going on in London? Tell us about that.
So the play, this much I know, my play that was at Aurora last fall is going to be in London in the winter. So they're having auditions now and I will get to go over for a little bit. I'll go for the first week of rehearsal and then I'll go back for previews and opening.
Is it the same producing team that did Eureka Day?
No, it's at a theater called the Hampstead Theater, and it's a much smaller production than the Old Vic. It's in their like second stage space, their like studio space. So it's a nice theater, and it'll be fun, I think.
I feel like it would be appropriate to ask you to tell us real quick what the shortest version of What This Much I Know is about, because I feel like it's relevant to what we talk about here.
I wish I had a good short version. I mean, the way we make decisions, the way our mind, you know, processes information, and then more specifically in the play, like the space between culpability and responsibility for something. Mm. So, like there are things in which we may not technically be responsible for them in any real legal sense, but we still feel like we are culpable for them. So there's a bunch of different storylines. So kind of at one end of the spectrum with that is like somebody who accidentally killed somebody in a car accident. So like that was not at all their fault. And everyone, you know, can agree like that's not their fault, but they still feel, but it's still something they did and still they feel responsible for. And then, you know, and then it's sort of, there are different degrees of that. I mean, then there are, I mean, two different characters who are the children of kind of monstrous people and inherited some of that ideology. And so then what is your responsibility or culpability to kind of this, the, you know, beliefs that you were raised with, things that you did choose, and then where your choice lies, and other things in the mix there as well. I've been reading this really wonderful book about playwriting by a writer named Sherry Kramer. Do you know her?
Yeah.
She wrote David's Red Hair Death was her most, I feel like.
I know of that play. I don't know it.
I feel like people always did scenes from it in college. She's great. And she has this great book on playwriting. It takes a very sort of different, it's new, like a different tact than a lot of the ones. But she has this part where she talks about how some plays make their meaning horizontally, which are like plot-driven plays where it's really about the sort of forward journey that is how the play makes its meaning. And some plays make their meaning vertically, which is about like sort of things layered upon each other and like stacking up. And it's not necessarily about like the drive from one moment to the next, but it's about the way things sort of accumulate. And
makes me think of like Caught, like Chris Chen's stuff, and our play the Chris Chen play we did, Cass.
You Mean to Do Me Harm.
Yeah, that was very, I would call it circular, but it was also kind of, what is this? Not horizontal.
Horizontal stacking rather than, vertical rather than horizontal, right.
Well, that's an interesting idea. Do you, when you're writing a piece like this that has deep thematic stuff like that, does it tend to come to you like the themes are interesting you and then you start to write people talking about those themes? Or do you find yourself running into a theme after writing about people talking or people living?
I mean, every play is different, mm-hmm. I mean, which is the unfortunate thing about writing, you know, is that like the thing you did before doesn't help you in any way with the thing you're doing now.
Yeah.
So I think it's always, I mean, I think so the way in is always different. You know, it often begins with some question or something that I'm kind of trying to figure out. And so sometimes there's an idea and, you know, sometimes it starts with the idea, but then you don't really know what the idea is until it's in the bodies of characters. And so, yeah, I don't know how to answer that question.
How about with this one? Did it start with these ideas or did it start with characters?
Yeah. I mean, yes, that one very much started with like reading a book, which was this guy, Daniel Kahneman, who's a Nobel Prize winning psychologist who kind of, he and his partner's work was really like all of these ideas about like unconscious biases in our decision making, which is not just like, you know, racism, but is like a billion different ways that we are influenced. Like that's all comes out of their work. And in that book, you know, he's like showing you some of these experiments and of how we make these cognitive errors, and you can sort of feel yourself, your brain like doing that while you read it. And so there's something like that felt very theatrical about that to me in a certain way. And so then I was like, okay, maybe there's a way to make a play. And I've always been obsessed with this company, Theatre de Complicité. I don't know if you've ever seen their work. And
I know of them, yeah.
You know, they do this thing. I mean, it's totally different because it's like ensemble created work they make over many years. But there's, you know, often in their shows, like they will have some like idea at the center, but then find a way to like theatricalize it in a way that you really can like feel in a visceral way. And I've always wanted to try and do that, even though, because it's just so cool. Like they have, you know, like this play Mnemonic that's all about memory, and or like a disappearing number, which is about math, you know, which doesn't seem like it would be
theatrical,
but it incredibly is. And like there's this amazing moment at the beginning of that play where like this woman just like comes out on stage and starts like giving a lecture about math and like writing these equations on a chalkboard, and it like goes on for like quite a long time and you have no idea what she's talking about. No higher math, I guess. And then this other guy comes out on stage and is like, hi, you know, I'm welcome to the play, like we're, and he, you know, he's like sort of doing this like monologue, and he's like, you know, the thing is, like, this is a play. It's like everything on stage is fake. Like this telephone doesn't work. I'm an actor. She's an actor. The only real thing on stage is the math.
Oh, that's cool.
Like math is real.
Yeah.
In a way that, you know, most like many other things are not in this world, you know, and it's because it's just true.
Right.
And it's, yeah. So anyway, that's
really, really interesting. I'm going to say something so tangential and strange. Bear with me.
Okay.
We're going to get to a thing. As I'm watching you talk, I haven't seen you in a while, and I'm watching you just like move the way you move and speak the way you speak. I'm trying to find the way. You remind me of three particular friends of mine, all who are Bay Area Jewish men.
Mm.
Like you're...
I am indeed a Bay Area Jewish man. Yeah.
I know. I think what I'm just marveling at is there is a thing. You know what I mean? There's a thing. There are things about cultures that show up. And it's your mannerism. It's like shocking me how similar to three other people I can think, specific human men. I have nothing else to say about that is insightful, except to say like, wow, that is really surprising. And it happened to me recently another time. And then I'm going to come back to something more interesting you said. But just like culture, though, that's a big, you know what I mean? Like you're you and you're individual and you're not those three men and we're all very unique. And I study this thing called human design, which is the science of differentiation. Like I'm really into the very specific, I'm not like all Jews are the same kind of lady, but I find myself doing stuff.
Katie goes, but.
Yeah. I find myself
like her
doing,
Florida Jew self.
Yeah. I find myself like, do you know what I mean? How when like the layers of culture just catch you and you'll look like, you'll be like, you'll catch yourself in a Marshall's window and you're like, I'm my Jewish dad. Like, it's just there. There's no, or on my mom's side, like I'm suddenly like super Irish Catholic about something and I just catch it. But like, I don't identify as that. And I don't feel like a Catholic Jew. I just feel like Katie Rubin.
Yeah. I mean, I think about this in terms of, I mean, in terms of writing, and I'm sure it's the same for acting in some sense of like that you can always, you're only, some sense you're like always writing yourself.
Right.
You know, characters, but you know, it's kind of boring unless you only want to do,
right,
you know, autobiographical one person plays.
Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
There is. There's a lot wrong with it.
But yeah, no, it's funny because we were in this same play. I just sat in for a day of auditions for like a month ago in DC, where they're doing this play at Theater J, which is like the Jewish theater in DC, even though it's not an explicitly Jewish play in any way, but I'm Jewish. So I guess they figured like that's good enough. But we were, you know, we were talking about a certain actor who, even though the role is not Jewish, you know, the actor was, and like, would that work? And one of the people who was in the room, I was the casting director, it's Theater J, so like everybody in the room is Jewish, you know, on the other side of the table.
Yeah.
And the casting director is like, well, that makes sense because like the way the character reasons is kind of Jewish in its sensibility.
Exactly.
And I was like, oh, wait, at this moment, I was like, oh, wait, are all my characters secretly Jewish? You know,
right.
I you know, because it's me writing them, you know, even though they're not in the, I don't know. It sort of sent me spinning a little bit of like, oh, right. Well, it's just, you're always you. And just like, you know, as a writer, everybody, you hope to write dialogue where each character is distinct and
sure,
unique, but on some level, everybody sounds like you to varying degrees. Some writers are,
yes,
are more or less in, you know, on that spectrum, but it's a little bit inescapable.
Yeah, totally. Now back to a totally maybe unrelated, but maybe there's a thread. The other question, which is, for Eureka Day, a different play of yours, did that start as an idea, or did that, where did, what was the nugget or the kernel of that play?
It was, I mean, it was this thing of, yeah, just like having a conversation or just like realizing that somebody I knew who I, you know, thought was and still think is like very intelligent and like basically, you know, has the same like politics and like broadly the same worldview that I do, that they didn't, you know, vaccinate their kids and didn't, I don't know, I wouldn't say they don't believe in vaccines, but they didn't, you know. And so like that just sort of was very, it was just strange to try and understand like how that was, that we could be the same in so many ways, but
yeah,
in this one very specific thing, like kind of live in different reality.
Totally.
So that was kind of the spark. And then I did a bunch of interviews with people about most, you know, just people who
vaccinate and people who don't,
their kids or and some other people as well. And just, yeah. So that was sort of where it started to.
Got you. One thing I love about that play is how prescient it was. I mean, this was before COVID. This was kind of just before COVID.
Yeah. I started working on it 2016 because the other big spark for that play was like, you know, the lead up, like the lead into the 2016 election.
Right.
And like at that time, you know, I feel like to some of us, it was the degree to which other people in our country live in a reality that is not ours, I think I at least had not fully grokked before we got into that election.
Just how deep that schism ran.
Yeah. Like I remember there was, at some point I was like taking my car into the shop in downtown Oakland. And like, you know, at that time, like all anybody is talking about is Trump, like, and you know, it's like,
yeah,
October 2016 or something. So like, there's like another woman who's being checked out, you know, at the desk by some other guy, and they're talking about, you know, Trump or whatever. And I sort of like join in their conversation. And then the guy who's like at the counter with me is like, yeah, I mean, Trump's not perfect, but Hillary Clinton murdered 27 people. So you know, what are you going to do? And the three of us are like, what? And then we sort of start asking him more questions. He's like, well, My wife is the political one, not me. I don't, but like, you know, she.
Right, because it's not, it goes past belief. And like you said, it's different realities. It's not even like past, well, I have a slightly different take on that. It's like perception becomes a different frame entirely.
Right. Well, and that to me then, I mean, really became what the core question of that play was, is this idea of that, like, the kind of Enlightenment era idea that, like, informed certainly, like, the writing of the Constitution, among other things, is that, like, you know, we are creatures with the ability to reason. And if, like, you know, fair-minded people come together, even if they have different beliefs, that, like, you know, you will be able to, you know, work out a solution together, mm-hmm. you know, by hearing all of the different points of view. And but that actually, like, that only works if everybody is operating out of, like, a shared set of facts. And if you are not, then you can't really have that function, because...
Well, and you all have to be operating from a shared willingness to hear and consider and reason and change.
I mean, a friend of mine who's a critic, you know, had a take I really like on Eureka Day, which is sort of about, like, the disillusionment of the Obama years, of, because Obama, like, as a person who really did believe that, like, okay, yes, we have disagreements with the Republicans, but we, you know, we can be fair-minded and we can, like, find a common ground. And then, like, but that doesn't work if people on the other side are like, no, fuck you. We don't want to find common ground.
Right.
You know,
that's, like, my point.
And then, yeah. I mean,
yeah. A willingness.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty interesting. It's an interesting moment. There's a
going to be, and it'll be interesting. Yeah. So then that play feels, I mean, obviously feels different now. I'm about to go next week. I'm going to Germany first I'm stopping in Berlin for a few days, but ultimately landing in Austria to see a German language production of that play at the Berg Theater, which is the national theater of Austria.
Wow.
That's going to be, but they're still setting it in the US, I assume.
I mean, I have no idea what they're going to do. I had one email exchange with the translator and I was like, do you have any questions? And he was like, no, I'm good. So.
So curious.
Who knows? But
how cool.
It'll be interesting to see what, I mean, and if you want to, you know, feel really depressed, you know, when I was emailing with the dramaturg at the theater and he was like, yeah, so, you know, we have a standing company ensemble of 70 actors. You know, occasionally we need to cast outside the ensemble, but we really try to use the ensemble. And then he was like, so our rehearsal will begin in May and they'll rehearse for a month. And then the company has its customary 2-month vacation. Ah! And then they'll resume, you know, rehearsal in
what?
September.
When are we moving there?
Yes, it's very...
Europe.
Wow. And they do something like, I mean, I think they have multiple spaces, but they do 40 or 50 plays in rep in a season. So, like, this play will perform, like, once every 10 days for a year. It's just so, I mean, it's just a totally different way of...
Say again, where this is Germany?
This is Austria, but I think it's the same. It's like the German model of...
I know two artists, one visual and one theatrical, who moved to Germany specifically because they learned the way that the German government works with artists. The way you just go, like, I would like to make a play about kittens. And they're like, here's $50,000. Because what? Like,
yes.
It just...
Well, I just saw online like a month or two ago that they had approved the arts budget for Berlin, just Berlin, not Germany, next year as $1 billion.
Oh my God. What are we doing here? Let's all move to Berlin.
Yeah.
We have two friends who just did.
Really?
At least. Jeremy and Kendra just moved there recently.
Oh, really?
What? Yeah,
Jeremy, Vic, and Kendra.
See? People get it, and they go.
They just wanted to go.
Wow.
I think one of them is able to possibly get citizenship eventually if he wants it. Jeremy, I think, so they're checking. They're just like, you know what? Let's be here for a year and see how that goes.
Yeah. Fuck yeah. That's the business. Other on this tip, and back to something else you said earlier, Jonathan, Kat Zidane?
Sure.
By any chance? Yeah. So Kat is presently, yesterday flew on an airplane to London. Today is walking around the gardens of Hampstead Gorillas, whatever it is, swimming in some like ponds, the swimming ponds of Hampstead Heath, you know, some wonderful England thing. Because Lauren Gunderson's new play that is based on Kat Zidane, a character.
Oh, I didn't know it was based, that character is based on her.
Yeah, so her play opens, Lauren's play opens, I don't know, today or tomorrow or something, in somewhere in London.
But Kat's not in it, just based on.
What?
Kat's not playing herself?
No. She has a full-time job, but like it was fun for Kat because she was brought in to meet the whole cast and the woman playing the character based on her. And they had their face-off moment that was really cool for everybody and other dimensional. And yeah, it's a play also that talks deeply or thinks deeply about the specific kind of work Kat does, which is UX, like user design, but the words that Google says.
Uh-huh.
So she's a writer, essentially, just she's writing, like, if I say to Google, where is Target, as opposed to how do I get to Target, Kat's writing the answers, you know, what would be the most logical response for Google to say?
I don't know anything about any of this, but that sounds to me like work that is about to be obliterated by AI.
Well, it sure seems that way on a certain level, but then on another level, maybe not, but probably. Her thing is...
as with all of us.
Yeah, you know. For sure. We're all going to die. It's okay.
We're all going to be rendered useless.
I mean...
I've read a couple articles recently where they've run like scenarios and tested who is most replaceable by AI. And it consistently comes out to be the CEOs and the administrators.
Really?
Not the, like, they literally like ran a, I don't remember how they did it. I don't know what the methodology was. I'm sure this is the result they wanted. So they tweaked it. But they were like, okay, you think you want to replace writers? I wonder if you could be replaced by AI and if that would be a more efficient use of AI for your company, Discovery HBO. And it turns out, yes, indeed. Innovation at that level is far more effectively instigated by AI than it is at the level of the creator. So just saying, I'm amused by that result.
Well, I mean, not to spoil it for, you know, the hordes of fans you have, but my newest play, which is going to be at Shotgun in the spring, is about a theater hiring a new artistic director. And after, you know, many hijinks, you know, they ultimately hire an AI, you know, program to do it. And it's funny because when I first wrote the play, when I first finished a draft, you know, 2 years ago or something, and I had sent it to my agent and she was like, oh, I love this. The one bit I don't quite buy is the AI thing.
But that's a real thing.
People are like, oh yeah, you totally wrote this in response to the present moment. Right. But the reality is, like, you look around it, especially now, like the theater season announcements, and you're like,
yeah,
that could be, like, an AI could do that. Come on. That's like a pretty, I just saw one today. It's like, okay, three plays that were hits in New York last year and four well-known titles that are adaptations of
there's a formula.
Main texts and like,
yeah,
a little Agatha Christie.
Yeah, a little Clue the musical, no big deal. Cool. Okay, great. So on that topic, but in no way on that topic,
yes.
If I say to you,
yes,
the word, get ready for it.
Okay.
Spirituality.
Yeah.
Or consciousness.
Okay. Okay. I think of those very separate words. Yeah.
Yeah. Very separate. But like, what do either of those words mean to you? And how do you relate to them in your day-to-day life? Another way to say it would be, do you have a relationship with anything you would call spirituality? And if not, do you have a relationship consciously with anything you would call consciousness?
I mean, I, it's a good question with the spirituality. Like, I do, you know, my parents are, you know, conservative Jews, conservative, not in the like right left political spectrum, but in the Jewish sort of in the middle, basically, for Jew, you know, there's like Reform Jews who are like the most chill, and then like conservative in the middle, and then Orthodox who are like the, you know, we don't drive on Saturday. And so we would, you know, my father would and still does. Well, now on, I, you know, go to synagogue like every Saturday and kept kosher in the house. And I grew up going a lot and had a bar mitzvah. And so I feel like I, in part because maybe I felt like always forced to do it, I certainly like, once I was no longer obligated, like didn't want to go. But just from growing up, like you have a certain connection when I do go to synagogue and you know, the prayers that you grew up knowing, like you feel a certain, you know, being part of a community, like you feel something in my, you know, my daughter, she, you know, we have her in Sunday school at the, you know, at the synagogue here, and went, you know, on Saturday for the, or Sunday for the first session and they have a little service. And so I do, yes, because of that, in that way that when you grow up with something and so you feel, you have a certain feeling, and you do in moments feel, even if like intellectually, I don't believe in like, you know, it falls apart very quickly if I start to analyze it intellectually, but then there is something that you feel. And I do, you know, I guess I have a desire to have some more of that in my life, if I could find a way that felt, I felt good about, or felt, you know, cohesive and consistent to me. And certainly, like, being part of a community is a piece of that, or as important of it as everything else. Consciousness, I'm not sure exactly how to answer that question. I mean, I am aware that I have a consciousness, and
here's a way to think about it, just because this tends to be a way in for a lot of people. It's like, so the Buddhist idea would be something like, when you're meditating, you're dropping your identification with an individuated self to a certain degree and merging your sense of awareness or existence or your own sentience is sort of merging into this field, you could say, of conscious awareness that exists past you.
Yes, I did a lot of psychedelics as in high school and college. So that is
great.
So my connection to feeling at one with the universe, really, I can my experience of that is you know, mostly from psychedelic experiences.
Does that stay with you at all in terms of your, like, the ethos you operate with in life? Like, did you learn anything from any of your psychedelic experiences or any meditative experiences or Jewish experiences that whereby some kind of awareness you came to in through a consciousness expanding experience stayed with you and is valuable in some way?
In terms of the drugs, I would say no. I mean, I think you, as often, like, you think it's going to, and you're like, the next day, you know, after taking acid the first time, you're like, oh yeah, now I'm really it's totally changed. I really, you know, but like that doesn't, at least for me, like,
it didn't stick
over time.
Okay.
But I can see how, it, you know, it's possible for that it would for people, or why people have these, I don't know, can imagine, you know, people have it when they have these, like, ecstatic experiences.
Yeah, but so for you personally, do you have a sense of feeling connected to the vast oneness of the all that is?
I would say usually no. I think the place where it's complicated for me is in terms of, you know, creativity, because and the thing is, like, a lot of people who write books about creativity and even books that I like and have found something, there is often a, I mean, almost in the, like, AA sense, this, like, you have to give yourself over to the higher, because you do, I mean, because on some level, like, you do have to, like, have faith that, like,
something's
going to come, something's going to work out, like,
yeah.
If not, like, how could you? And it is, on some level, like, you know, feels miraculous that it happens.
Sure.
Know? And it does, you know, so it is, you know, so there is this, and so I can connect to the feeling that I need to, even though I don't always do it, like you're sort of opening yourself up to this, not that the ideas are coming from outside of you, but that they're, you have to have a kind of, like, that there is something fundamentally, like, mysterious, at least to me, about like how the creative process works. And you have to, like, accept that mystery, you know,
right.
And have some faith in it. But I don't necessarily then take that to mean that therefore there is some higher power who is, like, feeding me these creative impulses, you know.
Totally get that. So for you, it's like it all comes from your creativity. That would be
no. I mean, I think again, it can be both things. Like the feeling of it when it happens can sometimes be like, oh, it's coming from, like, that you are from some other source, and so you can have that feeling. But it then, like, intellectually, I don't like think that is what is happening.
Hmm.
If that makes sense.
What do you think is happening?
I don't, you know, I mean, I think your brain is, like, making connections between things that are not, I mean, I think most, you know, most creativity is like a collision of two things that don't obviously go together, and that, like, sparks something into some third thing.
Right.
I think you can put yourself in states where you are more receptive to to those things than other. I mean, it's like the, you know, the cliche but true thing of, like, you get great ideas in the shower or, like, when you're on a walk, because your brain is, like, being put into a certain state where then you are just, like, more
receptive.
Yeah.
But what you're receptive to, from your point of view, is new ideas.
Yeah. I mean, ideas. Yeah. I mean, if ideas. as a word that, you know, stands in for a lot of things, I guess.
Yeah. I'm having the experience listening to you talk that I have a lot of times when I would call myself like a spiritualist or like a consciousness lady, which we could talk about for hours. What does any of that mean? But then when I talk with, and my boyfriend is an atheist, like nothing, none of it, but he meditates Buddhistly. So I'm like, I don't get you, man. But like, I don't need to get him. It's fine. We like each other. The point is, the people who identify more in the world as atheistic or non-spiritual tend to be, their philosophy, when you dig in far enough, is so philosophy that takes a person to, how do I say this, where no thing is actually locatable in space. Like the way you talk about ideas, if that's a word that describes a thing that maybe is or maybe isn't, that sentence is very spiritual to me. It's very consciousness to me. It's very expanded past, like you have a very open way of holding reality. And I find that a lot of atheists are that way. They have a very open way of holding reality and they behave very kindly to other humans. And they're like, well, I'm just trying to be like kind of not a dick on this earth and like maybe be nice to people and like have a nice care about others and try to do okay. Don't kill the trees. Like, which in essence, if you talk to spiritual people, is like what they're trying to get to just like, you know, spirituality is to help you just be less of a dick and like try to help the trees a little. You know what I'm saying? Like it all ends up being like the most spiritual people I meet are often atheists because of spiritual being, if you're actually applying principles to reality and thinking about reality in a way that where all the things that are tied together get untied and loosened. That is consciousness. Consciousness to me is like the field of conscious awareness from which all things arise, but it's not married to anything being any kind of way. And then humans come along and they go like, well, it should be like this and it should be like this because my mind said.
No, I mean, I don't know that I would say like with 100% that I would call myself an atheist rather than like an agnostic or that, you know, because I mean, I feel confident in the realization that like, you know, when you like read or listen to like physicists talk about like the universe and time, you're like, okay, so there is just like, there are ways that the universe functions that actually like our human brain is not built to perceive or understand. Right. Cause it's just like, you know, so there's like, yeah, there's a limit to our understanding, you know, like that it just like makes your brain hurt when you try and think about like, well, what came before the Big Bang? And the scientists are like, nothing, you know, like it doesn't, because it's before there was no time. So like not like time began at the Big Bang. So you can't actually, your brain cannot conceive of what that thing was that existed with before there was time. Time is how we experience reality, you know? And so or, you know, even in a simpler way, when like people try and explain to you how there is infinity and then there is infinity plus infinity, and that's bigger than infinity. My brain doesn't work that way.
Well, the only thing real here is the math. So
yes, like the math is there.
Okay. Now, here's what I would say to that, just for the sake of fun conversation. What I would say is, no, the brain can't conceive of that, but I would say that the heart can and the being can. In other words, when I enter certain states of consciousness, I have no problem conceiving of no time, the time before time, infinite time or infinite space times infinite space, whatever. I don't have a problem with that from if I'm sitting in the space of a sort of expanded state of conscious awareness. But I define awareness as it's not a thing your brain is really doing. Your brain is like a vehicle through which understanding of consciousness moves, but your brain can't understand big beyond. It can't, but your being can.
Yeah. I don't know that that is a distinction that is meaningful for me, but I...
Gotcha. See, and I think that would be the difference between us, right? As humans.
Like, because in my mind, like, if I'm, and when I have, whether it's with the aid of substances or, you know, through my own experiences, like felt that sense of whatever I'm feeling that is more expansive than my moment-to-moment lived experience. Like, in my understanding of what's happening, it's still my brain is still doing that. It's just something different than it does in my day-to-day life.
Yeah, I don't see it that way, but I hear you. And that would explain, that would make perfect sense. If that's how you, if that's what you think is occurring, well then, duh.
That's my ongoing constant struggle. I constantly hold, we were doing it, and you almost did it earlier, where you hold the two things kind of simultaneously. Well, like my brain says this, and well, but also what if that? That's interesting to engage with, but I'm not knowing it because I still have trouble divorcing knowing, the concept of knowing, from the brain mind rather than some other form of translation or perception.
Right.
Yeah, I guess also just for me, it's like I am open to the idea of other systems of understanding the world or other truths or whatever it is. It's just anytime I have encountered one and you get into the specifics of what that is or what that belief system is or what it, the claims, then it, like, for me at least, like, quickly falls apart on even on like with a small amount of scrutiny of like, well, okay, but how does this actually, it doesn't make any sense. Like,
I would wonder, are you speaking about religious ideas?
Well, I think religion is one bucket of that. And then like astrology, you know, it's like component parts, or like at the more extreme, the thing that, you know, the, like, what is it called? Like the secret, you know, the people who are like, I can manifest my desires if I have my vision board. And it's like, well, what about all the, you know, people throughout history who have been like tortured and starving, were they just not manifesting like hard enough? Like, you know, or so, yeah.
Well, I mean, some of us have answers to those questions.
Okay.
We don't have to talk about them. I'm just saying. I'm just saying, like, that is an argument people make. Absolutely. Yes, of course. I have my own. So I work as an energy healer, right? So I work with people all day, every day, using what I call conscious light or divine conscious awareness to change the energy of trauma in the body and in the heart. So one of the things that we come up against a lot is the thing you were, I just lost my train of thought, but the thing you were saying about, oh yeah. So people get frustrated. They come to me and they're like, I did my vision board and why didn't it work? And something that people don't understand is that about vision boards, which that whole The Secret really pisses me off, because it's like they told people half the story. So half the story of manifesting is think about it a lot, feel about it a lot, and you're going to take actions that lead you to having it. Sure. You know, if you do, or you're going to pull it into you energetically, which I do believe is a thing you can do. But the piece that's key there that they didn't talk about in The Secret is that unconsciously, like, the unconscious mind is creating much more than the conscious mind is creating in terms of what you're experiencing in your 3D reality. So if you haven't done your trauma healing work and you're carrying the energy of like, people are scary because my dad used to hit me with a brick or whatever, doesn't matter how many vision boards you make, you still believe in an unconscious way you can't have that thing or whatever. So there's a push-pull in reality that makes it hard to create anything.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, I mean, this is the more mundane version. Like, I don't believe that, like, by that, like, you are manifesting something to happen in the universe. But I am a believer in my own, I mean, experience in, like, the value of, like, setting specific goals and getting specific about it because of that thing, because it does, then you are unconsciously, you know, priming yourself. You start doing things to make those things happen.
Right.
I think you know, that is more effective than if you haven't, like, done that goal setting. I mean, just for me, like, that has proven to be true.
Like, so, it steers the ship of your actions.
But the conscious unconscious thing is also, I mean, something with again, like, going back to creative work, like, I think about a lot, because my experience is that I have to, like, my creative process, you know, creative process, I don't, I mean, like, I is that I, you know, it's like writing is torturous and horrible,
mm-hmm.
and no one should ever have to do it. But if you do, you know, like, there's some.
But now come take my class.
Yes, exactly. part of what I now think is why it is horrible at the beginning is that I have not yet, it takes me some amount of time of conscious attention to a thing that I am working on before my unconscious brain will sort of click on and start thinking about this thing and working on it as well. And and that is where the good ideas come from. When I'm now just thinking about it in the back of my mind, that's when I get the idea in the shower or in the car or whatever. And those are the good ideas. But until that happens, I'm aware that I'm not getting the good ideas. And all that's happening with my conscious intention is the crappy stuff. And then you're just sitting there like making this bad thing, and it feels bad because you know it's bad. And that's the cycle of torture.
Yeah.
Of cheating. At least for me. I think it's a little different for other, everybody's different.
Oh yeah, sure.
I think there's some element in that is true. I mean, it's part of why switching between projects I find so painful for the same reason, because if you have to have different deadlines, because then I'm trying to shift my conscious mind to now we're going to work on this new thing. But the unconscious is no, I'm still working on the other thing.
Wow, that's cool.
You know, I just turn on a dime. And so then it's yeah. Although interestingly, then the workaround to this, or the hijack or whatever, is if I am in a process with other people, if I'm doing a reading or a workshop or something, I rarely feel any of that resistance. I'm much more able to just click on and just do the work. Hmm. Because for whatever reason, whether it's some combination of I'm, getting inspiration from the other people in the room, or they're, or drawing energy from them or whatever, or because I'm, not energy in the mystical sense, just jazzed by being around them. And
why not in the mystical sense?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm an energy vampire. I mean, or also the other part is if you have one day, if you have X number of hours between this day of rehearsal and this day of rehearsal, and you want to do it, it's now you have a very short deadline. And so you have no choice.
Yeah. So you're saying it's either some kind of connection between the people, or it's pressure.
Yeah.
Right. Sure. So have you ever believed in a thing that you didn't mentally understand?
As an adult?
Yeah. What about love?
Sure. Yeah.
But you can understand love, maybe.
Well, I mean, you can understand, you can have an intellectual understanding, and then you can have the experience of it. Mm-hmm. Those aren't necessarily the same things, but that doesn't mean it's unexplainable. It just means that you're having an, so it's not, I wouldn't put that in the category of something that there's a certain mystery to it, in the sense of when you fall in love with somebody and that person and you, and when that, so that, that you couldn't know in advance was going to necessarily happen. So, but it's not mysterious in the sense of to me at least, of why does gravity exist or something, which maybe there is an answer for and I just don't understand it. But
okay, wait, so that's a good one. So you believe in gravity?
Sure.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know that I believe in it or don't believe in it, but I
well, you experience the effects of it.
I experience it as a thing that exists.
Yeah. So you experience gravity as existing, but you don't fully understand it. Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
I mean, yes, because I don't have the science.
Sure.
I mean, it's true of most things in the world, is that almost everything that we encounter in our modern world, I cannot explain how it works, or because my knowledge of things is limited. I don't know how this Zoom works that we are on.
Sure, of course. Yeah. So then I want to go back to one other thing, and then I'm going to drop this topic. You talked about going to synagogue, having some kind of, you were like, well, there's some kind of sort of spiritual something, because childhood, synagogue, and the feeling you get. So, and then you said this, the feeling you get has to do with community, right? Something with community.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. So I don't know. I don't know what those, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know exactly the combination of community and nostalgia and, wish that I did believe in something that I don't, or whatever, there's what the soup of things is exactly that leads to whatever that feeling is, that you have a little.
What is the feeling? What does it feel like?
Yeah, it is that. I mean, that's, in a much, much more minor way, that, acid, I'm connected to something bigger than myself, you know.
Okay. So you're saying that when you're in community in the specific cultural context of the Jewish going to the place where Jewish people go together, that in that community experience, there's some kind of transcendent into a biggerness.
Yes. Although it's whether, you know, how, to what degree it's connected to that community, to the, you know, your, I mean, in the same way that like when you with music, you can have a sort of,
right,
you know, whatever transcendent experience of the certain song just like,
sure,
moves you in a certain way that like,
yeah,
sing along with that song, you know, like that's a thing that is happening to you because of that
feeling.
Yeah, that feeling.
Yeah. It's interesting because when you talk, another thing I hear in when you're talking is there's sort of two kinds of people with relation to the broadly speaking, with relationship to this idea of spirituality and or consciousness, which is people who need to find answers and people who don't. Like the way you talk about it, it sounds like, yeah, I don't know. That might be this or it might be that. I don't know. It's sort of not relevant to you, whether it's this or that. Does that seem right?
Yeah. I mean that, no, I feel like I don't really know, but I know enough for my satisfaction, you know, like,
yeah,
like what is, yes. So I don't know. There are other things that I don't know about that I want to know more about.
What are some of those?
I mean, that's like every
topic of every play.
Yeah. Basically is like a thing that I don't fully understand that I want to understand more about.
Which seem to be, well, let me see. Socially oriented or philosophically, like social and philosophical things that you don't.
Yeah. I mean, I think my way into a play is often, well, I don't know. I mean, it's weird. It's like, I want to say more intellectual, but I think that's not quite true because there's a thing that comes before the intellectual, which is like, yeah, having some experience. And then you're like, this is weird or confusing or interesting or whatever. And then, okay, well, let me figure out what the thing is that I want to find out more about and like dig into it or that feels like it could be. So like, yeah. So with the play that's going to be at Shotgun about a theater hiring an artistic director, like, so that moment was, when Aurora was hiring an artistic director after Tom left, before he had left, but he was leaving, and they invited the board, because I just had a play there. So they invited like me and like Joy Carlin and I don't know, like 5-6 artists, not to like be on the search committee, but just to sit in the room with the board when the final candidates like came through and talked to and like made their big pitch. And it was so weird. Like just like everything about it was so surreal.
Why? What do you mean?
Well, so on one level, you have these candidates who are like performing a version of themselves in this very strange way.
Yeah.
I mean, which is what they're asked to do, you know, to convince this group of people that they should be the one to take over this theater. And it's very presentational and very, you know, so, and then talking to the board afterwards about what they saw in candidates and just realizing that, and not to say anything negative about the lovely board, but just that they, at least as far as I understood, like did not really understand what an artistic director does.
Mm-hmm. Boards often don't.
They are the people responsible for making this decision.
Right.
Yeah.
Right,
and so like the soup of those things together, like was so weird and interesting to me. And so that was like the thing to explore more, or like the play that I'm in a painful slog right now on in the painful place, which I've been, you know, in part of it is it's a very research heavy play. So I've been researching it for years. So that's also part of why it's hard to get to the creative place. And the spark for that was I was watching this documentary it was about a couple of things. 'Cause it was like 4 hours long, but primarily it was about the trials at Nuremberg. And the documentary was made in the 70s. Mm. So at that point, most of the people who had been tried and convicted in Nuremberg, the ones who weren't executed, you know, were out of jail because they didn't, even though some of them were given life sentences, like they didn't really enforce that. So it was like interviewing both the basically like prosecutors and the people who had been prosecuted at Nuremberg. And it was a documentary called The Memory of Justice. And like the core question animating it is like, can the victors in a war ever preside over justice, or is it always going to be a form of vengeance?
Hmm.
And so it's a super fascinating documentary. And everybody's like very open. And like some of the former Nazis are like, well, like contrite, and some are like not at all, and like in total denial that they ever did anything wrong. So it's super fascinating. But there's this, in the middle of the documentary, there's this like 2-minute interview with this guy whose job was to, when they were, so at the end of the war, the Allies were all occupying Germany, and they were doing this process of denazification, which they called it, which was just like, make sure that nobody who had been, you know, like high up in the Nazi party or close to the Nazis could have any like position of power in the government or like in business or for this guy, like in the arts. So his job was to, you know, decide among like the musicians and like theater artists. And he's like talking about like, he's like, oh, it was really tough because like this guy, oh, he wasn't political, you know, he was an actor. He just cared about like, am I going to get to play Lear tonight? You know? And so how do you judge these people? Or like, he had this other great quote that I found, this guy where he was talking about this very famous German conductor who was very big time Nazi. He was like, the problem was anyone who'd ever once heard this guy play music knew that to not let him play music, you'd be punishing yourself more than you're punishing him.
Hmm.
There was no way to deal with him fairly. And like that, so that was the, like, so that just, you know, again, like this 2-minute little clip of this guy in this documentary, that like, that was the spark of like, oh, I don't know, but this is fascinating.
Like, yeah, that makes sense. It sounds sort of like that question of, that we all look at with like, when you watch Leaving Neverland, or whatever, and you realize
Finding Neverland,
whichever the one was, where you learned that Michael Jackson was a monster.
Oh yeah, I didn't.
High recommend. Please watch it, but it's fucked up. And then you got to deal with his music, or you have Louis C.K. and you got to deal with his comedy, and like different people have different, like, what do we do there?
Well, that's what's so interesting about this moment in history is like, rather than the culture having to decide collectively, it was actually like somebody's job to like make that decision.
Wow.
For people. And that then the other layer of it, most of the people doing this work were German or Austrian Jews who had like gotten out, you know, come to America.
Right.
Earlier, but because they were the people who spoke German.
Oh my God.
And who sort of knew the culture. And so they were the ones assigned to do this.
That's a really interesting topic and question. I have a particularly personal relationship to this topic in the sense that I feel like in my lifetime, this time around, I have gone from being someone who was pretty amoral. I was pretty like, nah, morals, nope. And like sort of nihilistic and self-harming and other harming, but also like free and lit, you know, all this, whatever. But like really, really far in that direction, like because of trauma. And then changing a lot of things internally in very deep, strange, complicated, long, many years ways that turned me into like almost the opposite of that, that I have a dynamic relationship with my own willingness to call myself on my own. Like if I were in that position, like I could answer for myself, is it vengeance or is it not? I think for myself, I could do it. Like I could make a choice that wasn't from vengeance because I know the difference so intimately between vengeance and, I mean, specifically vengeance as an 8 Enneagram cast knows this language. But anyway, but this is something I've thought so much about this lifetime is this question of like accountability, right? And even when you're justified in causing harm, you might say, or like punishing someone, knowing that you're doing it and then choosing not to. But for me, that comes from having experienced the pain of having done the opposite and learning how bad that makes me feel and how I don't like to do that to people. So I've thought about this a lot, just in my own life. So it's very interesting to me to think about a person in that position, having been through what the Jews went through in the camps. I mean, just, it's such a heightened version of a thing I've related to in a very intimate way with myself that at that level, I go, well, I think even with all the work I've done to look very closely at this, I think personally, I might know if I were them that I was doing vengeance. I'd be aware of it,
right.
But I might do it anyway. I might not. I don't know. I haven't been in this situation, but I'm saying there's two things there. There's the knowing whether you are or not, right? And then there's the doing it or not. You think you can't really know. I think you can know.
No, I think our brains are like really masterful at like
tricky bitches
tricking us I always think of, like, when I was, one of the times I was trying to quit smoking, I mean, which I ultimately did, but this was not the final time, but at least I found successful at the time, was what I realized was that the problem was, like, when I would feel the desire to smoke a cigarette, and then I would get into this internal tussle about, like, should I or shouldn't I?
Mm-hmm.
The problem was the nicotine was hijacking my brain.
Right.
The way it was making the arguments about why I should have a cigarette were the way that I reason through things. So they were, like, the best arguments.
Right. You know? Totally.
The arguments that I am most susceptible to, because it was my brain making them.
Yeah.
And so I had to get to this place where I would just say to myself, like, brain, you know, I know you're right. Like, you totally win this argument, but I'm going to ignore you anyway. You know, and like that. That's
what I'm talking about. But see, then I would argue that you do have the capacity to know.
Right. In that situation, I did, but only because, like, I feel like the effects of, like, nicotine and addiction, like it's a very like specific thing that had a lot of understanding over and had, like, thought about a lot and every, you know, like, versus, like, if I'm just, like, in a sort of murkier.
Yeah, but couldn't we say humans are addicted to vengeance or being right?
Certainly being right or I feel like being consistent more than being right.
Either way, right.
I mean, it's interesting. It's like with, I was in auditions for the other play on Saturday. I was in auditions for the play day. Like, auditions is, like, such an interesting way of, like, your brain and, like, figuring out, like, well, what am I? I mean, most of the decisions we make, you know, are, which is part of what this much I know is about, are, like, decisions that we have made, you know, if not unconsciously, with our sort of the lower part of our pattern recognition system.
Mm-hmm.
And that when we justify those decisions with our reasoning system.
Except that you can bypass that.
No, you can, but it takes great effort.
Yeah.
But we're lazy. So we don't do that, mostly, if we can avoid it, you know.
But you could, if you were the guy under the pressure of the gun of deciding whether the guys, we vengefully blah, blah, blah with the guys or not.
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, you could.
But you're saying we wouldn't.
You may or may not. I just think it's not always easy to know.
Sure.
Because our brain does the substitution thing where it is switching out. I mean, it likes to swap out, you know, a hard decision for an easy decision without us realizing it. So, like, rather than, you know, for instance, like, if I'm watching actors in auditions, rather than, like, answering the really hard question of, like, actually, is this person, like, the best person for the role? Maybe I'm instead, like, answering the easier question of, like, do I like this person?
Right.
Because that is an easy question to answer. And maybe I can tell myself that I've actually answered the harder question, but then I don't have to do the work of answering the harder question. And then I feel really good because I haven't had to work hard and I'm lazy. Not just me.
I get it. You know, humans.
Well, there's something that comes up when you talk like this about the hijacking of the brain with the cigarettes, where you actually did have to go to a different trust center, in a sense, and say, brain, not reliable. I know you're so convincing, but yet I am choosing to go to a different part of myself to trust a different part.
And that takes so much.
Yeah.
You know, that's so hard.
Well, that's why spirituality is work, or being conscious is work, because you have to choose to be the witnessing eye rather than your habits.
Yeah.
Even if your habits are just, I'm going to choose who I like instead of who's right for the role.
No, I mean, I certainly do. And my therapist has suggested it, you know, and I would like to meditate more, which I've done, you know, on rare occasions. And I, like, and it's just, like, have not been good about, like, creating
space,
the habit of it. Yeah, to do it consistently. But I do, again, like, without needing for me to believe that in meditating I am engaging in something mystical, I can believe that it is doing something for my brain that is beneficial to my experience in the world, and that is enough for me.
Where did the "it can't be mystical" thing start?
I mean, I just think I don't need it to be for me to feel like it's beneficial and useful.
But what if it were?
I mean, that's fine. I'm not, like, you know, if, but.
So you're not in pursuit of it, but you're also not in resistance to it. Mysticism.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, in a like extremely vague sense, you know, if that makes sense.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
I know it sounds like we're grilling you in some way, but we're totally not. I'm just, this is a fucking great conversation. I'm loving it. But it is actually, you and I have been talking sort of casually for a long time about like, oh, I should come on the podcast. I'm like, fuck yeah, let's get you on the podcast. And when I mentioned it to Katie, she was like, yeah, get him on the fucking podcast. I love that guy. So that's base level. And this is not me challenging you, but my question is like, why did you want to come on the podcast? You know, it's a weird woo-woo spirituality podcast. What was it that made you want to engage with that?
I like podcasts.
Just any, you're just like, I see the word podcast.
If you invite me to your podcast, I will be on it. That's my
podcast. My theory is it's about you and me. It's about, he likes you. You guys are friends.
Right.
And maybe me a little, but mostly you. And so therefore it's back to whatever, to Jewish community together. Heart together is some kind of something for him. Like it's the people, it's the community is his, we could say spirituality without saying spirituality.
But it wasn't specific to the, to the particular topic or the particular.
I mean, I've never listened to the podcast, and I
you only had the vaguest sense of what it's about. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was curious too. You know, maybe I would have my,
I love it.
You know, my life changed. I never know.
We might have planted seeds. You can come back, and we'll do a reading for you another time.
Yeah, I thought I was going to get a reading. I thought that's what I was promised in the email.
You want a reading?
I don't. Sure. Yeah. I don't know. Do I?
Do you?
Do you?
I don't know. Does it get dark? I don't know.
What does dark mean?
I don't know. It's like,
do you have a question?
What?
Do you have a question that you would like to ask
the universe
of whatever source it might come from?
Consciousness.
We'll call it consciousness.
Like if you could talk to consciousness itself directly, what would you want to know?
Like the universal consciousness of the galaxy, you mean?
The infinite wisdom of everything, everywhere, all at once. And or God, either way, pick your poison.
I don't know that I have a question.
Yeah.
Like that.
I'm not surprised. Do you have any, what about yourself or about your life or about you and your process or something in your own life that you'd like to be easier or better or different?
I mean, I would like my creative process to be, that's how I started therapy is because I was like this, actually I read this, the reason was I read this book written by a guy who used to be a professional screenwriter and then became a therapist and all of his clients are
screenwriters. Yeah.
Screenwriters mostly. And it's an interesting book, but one of the things he talks about at one point is he's like, you know, I have a bunch of clients who like, you know, the way they work is they just like procrastinate a lot and they like, they're really miserable and they feel bad about themselves. And then they like, you know, the deadline is approaching and then they like, you know, get spurred into action and they do a bunch of work and they like make their deadline. And there are a lot of people who have like a really successful career working this way. Mm-hmm. It can be a fine way to have a career, but it's a miserable way to live a life.
Right. Totally.
And I read that. I was like, oh yeah, that sounds familiar. So I was like, I would like to have a like, you know, a healthier relationship to my work.
Okay. I'll give you something that you can throw in the trash or take with you, however it lands. So I do this thing where, so I've been to 3 healing schools that are all based in like consciousness training and energy healing and connecting to the divine, whatever that means to you. And there are 3 very different systems that have sort of at their core very similar ideas, but also very different ideas. So to me, the ideas were not exactly relevant. To me, it was like the efficacy of the energy. Like, does the energy come into me and change me and make me more peaceful or transmute some trauma that I have that I've not been able to transmute with my mind? So I did 3 of those and they were each 4 years long. And as a result of that work, I have this ability where I can kind of, the way I would describe it to you would be like sit behind myself, like take my conscious attention behind myself, open my awareness left and right, up and down, forward and back, and listen to what consciousness would say, which is a different experience than if you, Jonathan, ask the personality ego mind of Katie Rubin a question. I'm going to sift through my brain and pull from my history and reference things I know or agree or disagree, whatever my ego mind and my emotions are going to do, that's you and me chatting. But if I choose to, I can turn all that off, pull my attention to consciousness and listen to what it says. Okay. So we can believe that or not believe that, but that's what I do. So that's one of the things I do. So I'll give you this much. As I'm doing that, I'm just listening to you talk about that. And I'm doing that. I go backwards and behind and around and up. And I start to ask it for Jonathan. And they go Vipassana, 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 consciousness. So Vipassana, you've heard of?
No.
Okay. Vipassana is a kind of meditation. There's many, many, you know, there's like zillions of like, where do you fucking start?
Yeah.
For you, I'm going, is it Zen Buddhism? Is it this kind of meditation? Is it TM? No. Vipassana, Vipassana, Vipassana. So Vipassana is a kind of meditation where, you know, there's a lot of retreats, particularly in this area. You can do the 10-day Vipassana or the 7-day or the 2-day. Then there's all the teachers that'll teach you the Vipassana. It's a simple practice. The practice of it is simple. It's noticing the breath and always coming back to the breath and then noticing any sensations and taking the breath to the sensation. And that's all. That's like way general teaching of Vipassana. But you in particular, if we're believing in me doing the thing I do, they're like Vipassana would work for you because A, it's visceral and B, you get to use the attention your mind is capable. Your mind is very powerful, yours. And so attention is a function of the mind, at least initially. And so you could put your mind, the part that's like to work, paying attention very effectively, like smart people can. They tend to be able to put their attention on what you tell them to put their attention on. And then if you say to them, cool, anytime your mind goes somewhere else, come back and put it on the sensations and the breath. You can do that as a person with a powerful this. So yeah, it'll also pull you down into everything below your neck. And last piece, you would need a specific kind of teacher who you really trust. And they would need to have, I do see it, it would be great if it was a man. And it would be great if it was a Jewish man, not because you can't see past that, but because something in the connection of that, the connection that is created between the hearts opens a certain amount of receptivity in your heart that makes it easier for you to drop out of the mind. There's like a trust there, if that makes any sense, energetically and emotionally, culturally, spiritually, that then unlocks something for you that allows you to receive more of what's being transmitted past the words that the Vipassana teacher would teach. And there's a guy coming to me, a specific guy. I'm going to find out this guy's name. And in the meantime, there's always books, right?
Yeah. I mean, what makes me think a little bit is the, I have done this only once and I really want to do it again, but I just haven't been able to make it work time-wise is, you know, this player at Eric N. Do you know who he is?
Mm-mm.
He is, he's been around a long time. He's sort of experimental playwright. I think he was literary manager at Berkeley Rep in like the 80s, you know, he's like, and then was a big leader in this thing in the, it was a little bit before my time, the RAT conference. Do you know this, Cassidy? It was called the regional like alternative theater movement. It was
early days
of the internet where like for sort of indie theater companies to like connect to each other. And they had like, anyway, he was sort of pushing that because he's always, you know, his work is quite experimental, but then, and then he's like, he ran the, you know, I think the graduate program at CalArts for some point, and there's playwriting at Brown, you know. But he, for about, he's a very spiritual person. I think he recently went to seminary and like got his degree. But is he's been for over 10 years running these silent playwriting retreats that you know will go. Some are like the one I did was 5 days. Sometimes they're as long as 10 days. They had this place in Texas they used to go, and he taught, you know, at these things. Like he talks to the group, and you. And sometimes to you individually, but you know, nobody else talks the whole time. And he's like giving you little assignments and giving you little sometimes like things to read, random poems. And then the idea is that you during this retreat, you write an entire play in this 5 days or 10 days, and that you you don't come in with an idea of a play you're gonna write. Just like he like brings it out of you with his like mystical powers, which I believe in for him.
Okay.
I'm being a little facetious. I don't really think he has mystical powers, but he has a technique that is mysterious to me and is effective, not just for me, but for like, I mean, many, many playwrights have.
Yeah.
I think like every play Anne Washburn has written for like the past 10 years has been like written on these retreats. She used to run the sort of facilitate them, the administration of them. Now Liz Duffy Adams is like administrating.
What's his name again?
His name is Eric N, E-H-N. So I that experience was really incredible of doing that retreat. And I would hope to get to do it again. But it is in a weird way, like, and he's talking about this, like, it's sort of the opposite of a meditation retreat where, like, you know, on those, like, you go and you're trying to, like, clear your mind to, you know, not have any, like, conscious effort or task, whereas here you're, like, very much engaged in a task, which is you are writing a play. And it's very, you know, a different kind of experience. But the silence was, you know, is fascinating to experience. So.
Well, two things I'd say there. One is there's another guy named Tom Bird who does a similar thing in Sedona that I've been to that you do for 3 days or 5 days or 10 days or something. He uses this audio track that he recorded and he plays it in the room and everybody's in the room together and you write in these 15-minute chunks and his thing is complete a book in the weekend or complete a book in the 5 days or however long you go. And I did, wrote a book. And I use the audio track in the writing classes I teach. And even my students that come in like, I don't know about all this nonsense, they come back because they're like, that shit worked and I like it. And what the fuck is all that?
Well, and it's true in this case, like it is this kind of experience would be the kind of thing that I congenitally would be very skeptical of.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But because so many writers who I really respected, you know, or we're like, this is amazing. Then I was like, okay, well, I'm going to suspend that skepticism and just like,
sure,
do, you know, give myself over to this experience and see what happens.
Yeah. You know? Well, so that was the first thing I was going to say. The second thing I would say in response is just that it's not actually correct that if, for example, on a Vipassana retreat that you're trying to empty your mind, that's a misnomer. What you're doing, it's much more active than that. You're putting your attention on a specific action within yourself. It's very doing. It's a doing that then opens another level of receiving. So there's a lot to do in there. And the old sort of Zen Buddhist idea of like, let go of the mind. It's not actually what's going on. It's pretty active. That's why I think, or I get that you would do well with that particular, for what it's worth.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's been good to talk to you, man.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming here. I'm so proud of you.
Oh, is that the end of my aura reading? Is just a recommendation?
It's not an aura reading, you fucker. Do you have other questions?
That was good advice, by the way. It was very specific and clear.
Do you have other questions? It doesn't have to be we have 2 minutes if you want more.
No, I think I'm good for the moment.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, thank you.
Well, we were happy to have you. And I'm always glad for a Jonathan Spector catch up and like, yeah. What the hell's going on?
Are you here now? Or are you in Sacramento? Where are you?
I'm in Emeryville.
Okay.
Yeah. We should all get together.
Let's
and play
all
racquetball.
Get together and play pickleball.
Pickleball.
Pickleball and drinks and whiskey in your backyard.
Oh, I'd love that.
And you also have a baby that I've never seen.
Are you serious?
Seen picture of. That's
nice. He's very cute. Yeah. He just started crawling just like yesterday. He's been working on it. He's 9 months old. He's been working on it for a long time. He's like been like rocking back and forth, you know, on his things. He finally started to put it together.
Wait, how many kids do you have now?
Two.
Okay.
He had a second.
Yeah.
I thought maybe there was a third in there, but rock on.
No. God, no.
God, no.
Congratulations.
Some people would say two, God, no.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I understand why they would say that, you know, but yeah.
There's the ineffable right there. The love one feels for a baby is probably transcends the knowledge the brain is able to comprehend.
It's true. Yes.
But then you're like, that's just biology.
Is that too? Yes.
Well, thanks, Jonathan. It was good to see you.
Yeah, thank you.
Great to see both of you.
All right.
Do your work, whatever it is.
Do your work.
What are you asking for? All of the answers. Say what? All of the answers. Yeah, all the answers.
Hey guys, thanks for listening. We'd love to hear from you. Please email us with your questions so that we have questions to answer in the Akashic Records. Our email address is allanswerspod@gmail.com. That's allanswerspod@gmail.com. And if you'd like to find us on Facebook or Twitter, it's at All Answers Pod. At All Answers Pod. Thank you.
Do your work.
Mixed and edited by Desmond McNeese for We Mixed It, LLC. Go to whatsoundsawesome.com.
Or don't.